This is an ABC podcast.
Good Pladale Getter and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Marion Farr. Today we take a look back at 2021 in Papua New Guinea. There's no doubt it's been a tough year, with several COVID-19 outbreaks pushing the country's health system to breaking point and families across the region losing loved ones. It's also seen families kept apart, including those in treaty villages in the Torres Strait, unable to see their relatives in Australia. Today we'll hear some of those stories, but also look back at other key events, from Rio Tinto agreeing to investigate its environmental legacy at the Panguna mine site in Bougainville, to the death of PNG's first Prime Minister, the Grand Chief Sir Michael Somare, and how some of PNG's artists use their talents to pay tribute to him.
I think it's a very uniting thing, and it's also a time to comfort each other, and it's time for artists to reach out and be able to express their feelings about the Grand Chief. He was not just a politician for the people of this land. I think he was more represented as a tribal leader, as the name given to him, rightly so, Grand Chief.
That and much more coming up here on Pacific Beat. This year, PNG saw its first COVID-19 outbreak back in March, and then it returned with a vengeance in September with the arrival of the highly infectious Delta variant. While official case numbers remain relatively small, experts say that's because of low testing rates. Anecdotal evidence paints a very different picture. Hospitals across the country were overwhelmed this year, and morgues were filled to capacity. Experts say low vaccination rates and high levels of misinformation created a perfect storm for COVID-19. Trying to battle the tide of misinformation can seem like an impossible task for governments and health professionals, but a number of Pacific celebrities took things into their own hands this year.
Gideon sees the talk, dives across.
Rugby union champion Will Genia is one of Papua New Guinea's most famous sporting legends. He's played for the Australian Wallabies, the Queensland Reds, and is currently signed with a Japanese team, the Kintetsu Liners. But off the field, he's turning his attention to another cause.
I sort of felt like it was in part a responsibility to be able to get a message out there to people to, you know, make them realise that they do have a choice, but to also then make a choice based on the right information.
The proud father and Papua New Guinean released a Facebook video sharing his thoughts about the COVID-19 vaccine.
But I do think the best way that we can protect ourselves, our loved ones and our communities is to get vaccinated. I've had my vaccine. It's simple. It's easy. We know vaccination saves lives. So I plead to you to go out there and get yours done today.
And for Mr. Genia, it's an issue that's close to home.
Yeah, my mum had COVID. My brother had COVID. I've had cousins and friends, you know, pass away because of the disease. It's heartbreaking.
In Papua New Guinea, social media has been blamed for contributing to high rates of vaccine hesitancy. In September, PNG even gave away 30,000 doses to Vietnam because there wasn't enough demand in the country. Mr. Genia says he wants fellow Papua New Guineans to be able to make informed decisions.
Giving them the right information, the right knowledge, the facts around the vaccine, around that it's okay to be able to take this, and then leaving that choice in their hands. And I think if you do that more often than not, you'll find that people will take the vaccine.
While some public figures are using their platforms to promote vaccination, others are not. Emmanuel Narokobi is a social media and marketing consultant in PNG. He's frustrated to see some high-profile politicians, singers, and even doctors spreading anti-vax messages.
It's a big concern because obviously we want to trust our doctors.
Mr. Narokobi believes the best way to combat vaccine misinformation is by engaging with local communities in person.
Face-to-face, sort of town hall type community gathering discussions, I think, would be more effective than just putting messages on media platforms.
He says it's all about getting the right approach.
Being able to try and find the right way to address them, not so much putting them down and shouting down to them, but giving them a space where they can sort of ask questions and be answered.
Others agree something needs to be done. Lady Roslyn Murauta is the wife of former PNG Prime Minister Sir Makere Murauta and a board member for Pacific Friends of Global Health.
My worry is that the pro-vaccination voices have not been loud enough.
The organisation wants the Australian government to support PNG to design a targeted COVID-19 information strategy.
We just have to have a much more active campaign of other respected people like church leaders and private sector leaders, community leaders, women's leaders and politicians as well. We have to have a concerted campaign that's very public.
While PNG may be experiencing the largest COVID-19 outbreak, it's not the only Pacific country struggling with vaccine hesitancy. Tongan royals, Crown Prince Te Pautoa Ulukulala and Princess Latufuipeka Tukuaho, featured in a Facebook video encouraging vaccination. In Auckland, a Pacifica health service, the Fono, has teamed up with local Instagram influencers to promote the jab.
Particularly our younger people who are the most resistant. And so they respond best with their own. And it's easier if we just have a number of people who are out there like a little army, bringing people into vaccination wherever that is the best place for them.
The organisation's chief operating officer, Sally Dalhousie, says so far it's been a success. She says building support from the ground up is particularly important within Pacific Island communities.
If the Delta variant hits our Pacific populations, it's more likely to spread quite quickly throughout our large families who often live in overcrowded situations.
For rugby superstar Will Genia, it doesn't matter where you are. His hope for all Pacific Islanders is the same.
My hope is that, yeah, there's more conversation created around it, but in a positive sense, in a space where it's safe to be able to express what it is you feel as an individual and then also hear the information.
That's rugby champion Will Genia there. Several high-profile arrests this year saw police in Papua New Guinea raise concerns that the country is becoming a haven for illicit drug manufacturers because of its weak narcotics laws. Officers recently raided the hotel room of a high-profile businessman and discovered a hidden methamphetamine laboratory. But the man in question has not been charged because PNG's outdated laws don't cover meth, which is often called ice. Now, as Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, the government is being urged to strengthen laws as a matter of urgency in a bid to stop drug syndicates from operating.
PNG police, working with Australian and US investigators, raided a hotel in the heart of PNG capital, Port Moresby. The location was the well-known Sanctuary in Waigani, the same suburb as PNG's Parliament House. They've confirmed they found a clandestine laboratory producing methamphetamines. Police also found several guns, and they've laid charges on the hotel's operations manager, Jamie Pang, for possessing those and ammunition without a license. Police say the 43-year-old is Australian, but he's lived in PNG for a long time and is well known in the business community. Local media reports he's pleaded guilty to 11 charges related to the weapons. But the head of the police operations, Donald Yamasombi, says they can't prosecute over the illicit drugs because the country's laws don't allow them to.
It's a slap in the face after much resources and time being put into investigating this kind of crime. And yet we cannot take it through the court process. It's just a waste of time and resource.
Methamphetamine is a stimulant that gives users a high, but it's highly addictive and often leaves users anxious, confused and violent. It's become increasingly popular in Australia, although it's illegal to possess it, supply it and manufacture it. Those caught trafficking meth can face more than 20 years in jail. But in PNG, meth isn't even included on the list of scheduled drugs in the country's Dangerous Drugs Act, which was written in 1952. And those caught producing or exporting other drugs like cocaine and heroin, which are listed in the Act, the maximum sentence is just 2 years in jail. Donald Yamasombi says the government must strengthen the law.
Now, we also put that as a recommendation to the police commissioner to take it further up, probably to the minister, to be elevated to the government, that we need to have the dangerous drug laws of the country. Currently, the one that we have is dated back to 1952, which is a long time ago, and that act needs to be overhauled. It needs to reflect the current situation. Methamphetamine is a new drug on the market, and it's not being reflected in that old act. So the whole act needs to be relooked at.
He isn't alone. Jose Sousa Santos is an expert in transnational crime and a fellow at the Australian Pacific Security College. He says weak laws allow drug syndicates to operate.
This is sending a very strong message to transnational criminal syndicates that the Papua New Guinea is a permissive environment, not just for the trafficking of drugs, but as has been shown with this recent case, but also as a point of production. And that is in itself extremely worrying. Producing methamphetamines in Papua New Guinea and then trafficking to Australia is much more cost effective than trafficking from Southeast Asia or, for example, from the US. At the moment, the 1 kilo of methamphetamines in Australia costs roughly $200,000. So there is a huge profit margin to be made.
The latest search comes off the back of several other drug busts. Last year, PNG gained international attention when more than 500 kilograms of cocaine was seized and an Australian pilot was arrested after a plane believed to be linked to drug trafficking crashed. While in October, a 31-year-old Australian man was charged with smuggling methamphetamine in PNG. It's become a worry for mothers in Port Moresby who fear for young people. Susan Sate is a community leader.
Papua New Guinea's new generation is in danger already. So whoever has brought that fact, what do you call it, laboratory in, never ever thought of Papua New Guinea's future.
Mrs. Sate believes many youth are vulnerable and would become addicted if they started taking meth.
We see a lot of kids with mental health problems. The main cause is a lot of it is stress. Stress from family pressures, stress from school, but mostly stress from peer pressure. And so we are cautious about and very worried about these things that will destroy our workforce, Papua New Guinea's workforce.
Susan Sete, a community leader in Port Moresby, ending that report from Bethany Harriman. And in early December, the government did pass its Controlled Substance Bill 2021 to try to bridge the gap in the country's drug laws. For more than 30 years, a massive open-cut mine in the Papua New Guinean region of Bougainville has sat abandoned. When violence broke out at the site in the late 1980s, the Australian mining company Rio Tinto had to desert the operation, leaving behind more than a billion tonnes of waste tailings. Locals say it created severe environmental and human rights issues. And this year, the mining giant agreed to come to the table and investigate the fallout. The cost for the company is expected to run into the millions, as our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
45-year-old George Posiona used to make a living catching fish in Bougainville, downstream from what was once one of the world's biggest gold and copper mines. But 2 years ago, mud and waste from the old mine site broke through and inundated the area where he used to fish.
The area we are standing in is our fishing area where we used to cross using canoes. Now we cannot do that anymore. We do not eat fish anymore because of the destruction.
He told the Human Rights Law Centre that he's concerned about ongoing damage.
We see that we are in big danger because this big destruction will not stop.
The Panguna mine was closed suddenly in 1989 when violence broke out at the site. The unrest turned into an almost decade-long civil war in Bougainville, which is thought to have killed as many as 20,000 people. Last year, more than three decades after the mine was shut down, the Human Rights Law Centre lodged a complaint against Rio Tinto with the Australian government. Theonila Roka Matbob, the local member in the Bougainville Parliament, helped file the complaint.
The impact that's caused by what was left behind, the legacy that was left behind, is basically everyday struggle, lack of accessibility to clean water, and also ongoing health complaints.
Rio Tinto announced it would fund an assessment of environmental and community impacts. Its former subsidiary, Bougainville Copper Limited, will also contribute to the costs.
It was a relief that it's been, I mean, especially to hear Rio Tinto trying to finally accept and come down and sit on a round table.
In 2016, Rio handed over its stake in the mine to the PNG and Bougainville governments. This will mark its first return to the site. The cost of the assessment alone is expected to be a few million dollars, but it will have to go to tender. Karen Adams from the Human Rights Law Centre says this is just a first step.
This assessment will need to be followed by swift action by Rio Tinto to help actually address these impacts and clean up its mine properly. That is what the communities expect. That is what we will be holding them to.
Rio says a joint committee of stakeholders will be set up so that they can consider the right way forward, and says it takes seriously the issues raised.
Natalie Whiting reporting. This year, Papua New Guineans were sent into deep mourning with the death of the country's very first Prime Minister, Grand Chief Sir Michael Somare. It prompted all kinds of tributes, including some creative additions by artists. For some of these artists, it was a process of discovery as they uncovered different sides of a man who was a staunch advocate of traditional Pacific culture. Inga Stunzner had this story back in March.
This house cry is part of traditional PNG culture following a loved one's death. And it was given full voice by the choir at Port Moresby Sir John Guy's Stadium. But there's been another type of tribute that's emerged since Sir Michael's death. Artists across the country have been sharing oil paintings, sand sculptures and street billboards, all depicting the Grand Chief's face. Even barbers have got creative, with images being shared of the founding father's profile shaved into men's hair. Others have been more subtle, like 24-year-old art student Derek Lendl's tribute, which is an incredibly lifelike profile of a smiling Michael Somare, drawn with a black pen on the palm of his hand.
Growing up, the name Somare was the name that we often hear about when he was small growing up. So when he passed on, it was like he faced a great loss in the country, and we appreciate what he did for the country with gaining independence in 1925 and all of those. So I felt like I should do a proper tribute.
Internationally renowned artist Jeffrey Fieger is also paying tribute to the Grand Chief by sharing a number of portraits he's created over the past decade. His style is contemporary, and one portrait he shared was painted at a public event within just a few hours.
Any good artwork reveals itself and reveals the process and gives you a sense of another perspective of seeing the person. I think that's the beauty of any painting and artwork, is that it's a window in which we can see an individual.
Jeffrey Fieger says art has been able to unite people as they've grieved for the late Sir Michael Somare.
It's also a time to comfort each other, and it's time for artists to reach out and be able to express their feelings about the Grand Chief.
But there's another reason why there's been such an outpouring from artists. Ruth McDougall, the curator of Pacific art at the Queensland Art Gallery, says Sir Michael Somare was a strong advocate of PNG's rich and diverse cultures.
Somare holds a very dear place in many people's hearts, and he certainly does for the arts community. His initial terms as Prime Minister were ones where there was enormous fervour in the arts.
Sir Michael got Australia to help fund a creative arts centre and national museum at Independence.
Contemporary Papua New Guinean art really was born at the time that Somare became the Grand Chief. Art plays an incredibly important function in PNG within communities as a way of communicating a sense of identity. And this is a way of communicating their identity as Papua New Guineans.
Ruth McDougall, the curator of Pacific art at the Queensland Art Gallery, also ended that report from Inga Stunzner.
There are less than 3 years before the next Olympic Games in Paris, when breakdancing will make its debut. Its introduction is part of the International Olympic Committee's attempt to attract younger audiences, which has already led to the introduction of BMX biking and skateboarding. Breakdancing could strike a chord in places like Papua New Guinea, where there's plenty of raw talent. Catherine Grau reports.
There aren't any dance studios here. This is Nine Mile, a settlement on the outskirts of the PNG capital, Port Moresby. It's dusty, hot and crowded. Many of the makeshift homes are made from scrap metal, and water and electricity can be hard to come by. But it's home to Carl Peter, better known to many as B-Boy Fly 40.
Well, Dave.
He's tipped to be PNG's best Olympic chance in breakdancing, or breaking as it'll be called when it debuts at the 2024 Paris Games.
I do breaking because I feel free when I dance b-boy. It makes me happy. Like it's giving me a reason to do something I love to do.
The 22-year-old's copped criticism from others in the settlement who question what he's doing. But for Carl, the small breakdancing community is his family.
So I come from a negative background where a lot of drugs and gang violence. So b-boy is a thing where I do, it keeps me away from them. And I know what's good from what I do.
He picked up breaking more than a decade ago after watching the man who's considered to be PNG's pioneer of the dance, George Tao, or B-Boy Monkey Stunts. Like so many of PNG's B-Boys, George Tao's life has been tough too.
Breaking itself, for me personally, became a way out from everything.
The little B-Boy community he's helped grow are all self-taught, relying on YouTube and each other.
In the earlier days, we just caught a spot and we all just turned up and trained each other. That's what we did. So I taught him something, he helped me, and we all helped each other. We're looking at people who come from broken families, people who come from a lot of, you know, struggles. So when they come to train, they train really, really hard. When they go home, they're back to whatever they face at home.
They're the sort of guys that the Active City Development Program in Port Moresby is trying to reach, teaching them yoga, kickboxing, acrobatics, and all genres of dance. Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess is its Director of Dance and Education. She says they have around 10 B-Boyers they're working with.
We know that there's so many challenges, not just the same as maybe a breaker who's learned breaking or B-Boying in a dance studio. These guys are learning it as the culture of b-boying started, which was in settlements, in the ghetto. B-boying was a communication. It was a way to communicate, a way to kind of dance out the stress. Before gangs were violent, they would dance, and whoever won, they had the territory.
Breakdance evolved in the 1970s on the streets of New York's Bronx District. 50 years later, in 2024, it will make its debut at the Paris Olympic Games.
No one saw this coming.
Dr. Rachel Gunn is a lecturer at Macquarie University who studied breakdancing, but she's also one of Australia's top breakers, known as B-Girl Ray Gunn.
It's not that breakers have been advocating for breaking's inclusion into the Olympics for years and years and years. This came out of the blue for us.
As B-Girl Ray Gunn, Dr. Gunn is currently tied as Australia's top female, and she hopes to qualify for the 2024 Games.
I'm training hard. I've got goals, certainly, to work towards Paris 2024, but it's still a few years away and you just don't know what's going to happen. I'm fortunate that, you know, I have access to a really fantastic coach and I'm in a good position at the moment.
But in places like PNG, it's not easy to access coaches, and it's something Carl Peter, or B-Boy Fly 40, is worried about.
It's our dream. This is what we've been practicing for, to go out and compete, you know. But it's just, we don't have enough support system.
At the moment, his support system is the breaking pioneer, George Tao, who runs sessions with his squad, the Tribal Breakers, most days of the week.
These are guys that train on the streets in really tough, and we don't train in gyms. Technical-wise, I'm very sure that they're ready. They can do it. But it's more or less the mentality to go along to take this, you know, all the way. And also the consistency. We can't just go in and out sort of thing.
That's exactly how Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess from the Active City Development Program sees it as well.
I see a lot of raw talent. What is needed here for dancers to succeed is consistency, is discipline and reliability.
But she believes it is likely that at least one of PNG's breakers could qualify for the Games.
Providing a different type of dance genre, a different type of sport, it might level the playing field. It might provide a moment for more representation for different types of Olympians.
Dr. Joanne Ball-Burgess from the Active City Development Program in Port Moresby ending that report from Catherine Grau. And I can't wait to watch breakdancing at the next Olympics. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thanks for your company. I'm Marion Farr.